everyone, and welcome to the Legendarium podcast, another author's shelf episode, and one that I am extremely excited for. This is the first time, to my knowledge, that we have definitely snuck a toe out of our genre. So this book is not sci-fi fantasy, and yet, or is it? Okay, we can maybe talk about that. Or is it? So my point just being, stick around, whether you've read the book or not. If we spoil anything, I'll let you know before we do. this is going to be a good conversation because I am joined today by an old friend of mine, Kayla Rivera. Kayla, how are you?
I'm good. Thank you so much for having me. It's exciting to be back.
You are a returning guest, and it would take somebody who is well steeped in the history of the Legendarium to know that you were on episode 135, where I think we were reviewing Breath of the Wild. So this is back in like, what did you say? 2017, 2018, something like that.
Yeah, I think it's 2017.
Yeah, it's so life marches on. It's been a little while since we've seen each other, but I ran into you at Brandon Sanderson's Dragonsteel event. You were moving books by the truckload. And we're going to talk about your books. There's a new one coming out, the third in the trilogy, the C.C. Rios trilogy for young readers. And it's what I've read so far is really, really, really good. So people should check it out. Either they should check it out or their kids should check it out, or, you know, whatever.
Yeah, agreed, honestly.
Buy two copies, and, you know, yeah. And you can throw one away. Just buy two, right?
Yeah.
All right. So I'm just going to skip all the housekeeping because I really want to get to this book. It's I Am the Messenger by, how do I say his name?
Marcus Zusak.
Marcus Zusak. He's an Australian writer. This book was published, I think, in 2002, if I recall correctly. And it won like Australian Book of the Year and various other awards. And it is not difficult for me to understand why. It is such a good book right up until the end. Okay, so we'll talk about that. No, I still thoroughly recommend this book, but I do have a problem with the ending. But before we get there, Kayla, I'm going to ask you, why did you choose our first non-SFF book? Why did you choose this book in particular?
Yes. Okay, so I picked this book because you were asking about like books that had strong impact on you. And of course, I write in science fiction and fantasy, love my high fantasies. I love children's literature. And this is none of those things, at the very least, to the naked eye. right. Marcus Zusak himself was just a huge, and his work was just a huge impact on me as a writer. And so, like, despite the fact that it doesn't look at all related to my stuff, it is completely defining.
I was going to say, that happens all the time. Like, if you listen to some album from your favorite artist, and they're like, oh, I was really inspired by, you know, the Beatles and Radiohead and Slayer. And you're like, where did all of this come from? I don't hear that. But these things rattle around in your head and kind of get spit out in your own flavor, right?
Right, exactly.
Like, sorry, I interrupted you. Go on.
I read The Book Thief originally, and I found it just in my library, you know, at like my high school library. That was one of the things I loved to do, is I just browsed libraries, randomly went through things, picked up strange books until I was like, yeah, I like this one. I think I'll read this one. That's how I found The Book Thief. Wow. And so I read that one first. Fantastic luck in the library. You know, I was like, oh my gosh, this became a movie later. It's gorgeous, beautiful, beautiful book. And that made me want to read all of Marcus Zusak's work. Now, he's not extremely prolific, but I love what he does. And so the next one I picked up was I Am the Messenger. And I loved that even more than The Book Thief. They're very different books. I wouldn't compare them. But personally, it's just something so... oh, it's mysterious. It's tense. It gets like deep into human nature. There's this really beautiful lines, and the way that Marcus Zusak writes alone stayed with me very powerfully. And then I started like even researching like interviews of his and things like that. And it was this book that just kind of propelled that. And the way he once later said that he wants to write so much like himself that when somebody reads it, you can tell, like, you have to tell that it's Marcus Zusak, and he does write that way. And that was like, I was a good writer at the time when I heard that and when I was reading these books. Like, it was good, you know, it was decent. But then I was like, that's what I want. Yeah, I want to write so much like me that someone's like, that's Kayla Rivera. You can tell it because of this or because of that, even if it's not like your sentence structure. And so I started writing books like that, and it just became really defining.
Is there any specific technique or style that he uses that you can identify where you go, oh, when I see or read that, I know.
Yeah, structurally, it's the way he uses fragments and paragraph jumps and things like that. Mm-hmm. Like, other people use fragments, they use paragraph jumps in, you know, similar ways. But the way it flows is so key to him, where sometimes he speaks almost the way that you subconsciously think sometimes. And then pairing that with sometimes just absolutely gorgeous, but not obvious descriptions. Like, I love the way he will sometimes describe things where you're like, I would not have thought of it that way, but that is kind of perfect. Yeah. That's like, those are big markers of his work for me.
His analogies and similes are, I actually mentioned this when we did our Game of Thrones episode recently. Martin does this as well, where Zusak will hit you with a really nice, colorful, evocative simile. And then he won't do that for a long time. Yeah. He's not banging you over the head with his gorgeous writing constantly. He sneaks it in at appropriate moments. Yes. And it's really refreshing to have somebody who can do that, but can also control when they do it. Instead of getting carried away with their own, cleverness or poetry or what have you.
Indulging a bit too much. Yeah. I would even say that was probably, I didn't even think about it until right now, but that was probably a big part of my writing too, because I'm a highly indulgent writer. Like, my first draft's incredibly indulgent. You know, I'm like, these are 100,000 words for something that probably needs to be 60,000.
right.
For sixth graders. It. Yeah, exactly. I'm like, this is for a fourth grader. This is for 8-year-olds. And I'm like, way too far, way too much. And I love doing that. So there's a whole process in my writing process of like cutting things out. And I learned from him really how to save it up. That's why I called, like, you know, you have to plan your punches. When you want something to mean something, when you want to strike your reader right in the diaphragm and take their breath away, you plan for it. You kind of clear the way for it, so there's negative space, there's space around it, you can take it in.
I like that
about his work.
Yeah. When I used to work, well, you and I used to work together, we were co-workers for a few years, and when I was at that company, I had interns that, well, the company had interns, I had one, right. But I was supposed to teach a class for the interns about writing for speaking, because I was doing video scripts and podcasts and all that stuff. So how do you write for speaking? And so I was going to give this hour-long presentation, and I had this idea. I'm going to have them do an exercise where I pull some articles or just snippets of articles from the New York Times, the Atlantic, National Review, whatever, you know, kind of bigger newspapers and magazines. And I would, you know, grab the intro paragraphs and give it to the interns and say, okay, so this was written to be read in your head silently. Let's write it to be spoken aloud. And I had the worst time. I could not find a good snippet to use for that. And what I realized after, you know, I'd gone through my 20th or 30th article in these big national glossy pages was that it was already written for that. It was already written so easily or in a way that could be spoken so easily that it flowed perfectly already. You could just speak what they'd written in the New York Times or whatever, what have you. Mm-hmm. And that's when I realized, oh, that in most circumstances, that is a mark of really good writing, when you can when it makes sense on the page and does interesting things like you're talking about, you know, page breaks and snippets and all that stuff. But I listened to the audiobook of this and mm-hmm. it flowed perfectly. There, you're in this guy's head, and mm-hmm. the and obviously the narrator has a great deal to do with how well it works, but the writing is such that you're never, when you're listening to it, you're never caught off guard by, oh, that was a weird thing to say. I don't know. That was a long way to just say that he has a casual, a casual accessible? Poetry. Yes. An accessible type of prose that, that at times dips into the poetic, and I really, really enjoyed it.
Yes.
Sorry. I get carried away.
He balances that. That's okay. No, it's such a good point, because I think sometimes, particularly in the literary community, we're like valuing people by, well, how good are your descriptions? How fancy can you get? And the truth is, even though that is a lot of fun, I love that, you know, obviously indulgent, you know, that the true mark of good media, perhaps we might say, is its ability to connect. And if you get in the way of connecting, because you're like, sit down, this is the best part. See, you see how what I did there? And they're like, yeah, okay, I see what you did there. You know? And you're kind of getting in the way of the impact you were planning for, you know?
Right.
That's not to say big, flourishy writing isn't also beautiful, but that, you know, I think accessible writing takes a lot of skill, actually. So.
We should talk about the story. And basically, this story, I Am the Messenger, is about an aimless 20-year-old Australian kid who has a small group of friends, and he has a job as a cab driver, but he's not amounting to much, right? Right. And
he's very aware of it.
And he's very aware of that, yeah, absolutely. One day, in the prologue to the story, he stops a bank robbery. And it's the one interesting thing he's ever done in his life, right? And so now he's in the newspaper, and everybody around this small town knows who he is because they all heard about the bank robbery. Shortly after that, he starts receiving mysterious playing cards in the mail with either straight up addresses on them or kind of a riddle to help him find the addresses he needs to go to. And when he goes to the address, he doesn't know why he's there or who's going to be there, but he discovers that the people at the addresses he's going to, they need something. They need help. They need the right message. They need companionship, even, is all. Mm-hmm. And so we go through the four suits of playing cards. And so there's four sets of addresses that he has to deal with. So it's essentially a book that's a series of vignettes describing all the people that he comes in contact with, and then the big mystery is who is sending these cards. Where did this all start? Who started all of this? So that's the bones of the story. Mm-hmm. And you know what, if we can stick with his style, I think this will ease us into the actual story. There was a phrase that he used quite a bit. And when an author uses a phrase over and over and over again, it can get wearying. And I was this close to being wearied by this phrase, and then I realized I wasn't. And it was that something was one of the most beautiful things I've ever seen, right? Mm-hmm. So whether he's watching the high school girl running barefoot in her track meet, or the estranged father holding his 2-year-old daughter for the first time and crying. And, you know, he sees all of these things, and it was one of the most beautiful things I've ever seen. And, you know, variations on that, but it happens over and over and over again. And I was almost annoyed by it until I realized that that's the point of the book, is that all of these things can be and should be one of the most beautiful things you've ever seen. What do you think, right?
I agree.
On the money here?
Yes. Well, because if you think about where Ed begins, like at the very beginning, this like lying to get a cab driver job, he even says like, being a cab driver is the crowning achievement of his career so far, you know, and he had to lie to get it. And he didn't even have to provide references because they were short staffed, you know. And he's just been severely disconnected, you know, with his upbringing. He doesn't have like a lot of love, but the fact that he knows that he's like kind of just sitting around in life, there's nothing particular going on. He's so disconnected is the biggest thing, even to his friends, because he and his friends definitely, they're hilarious, but like he and his friends even have like this significant distance between each other that allows them to like rib and, you know, and be like, you're the most useless person to each other, your car is crap, you know. And I what I love is throughout the whole story is it requires connection of him over and over and over. And it's actually that connection, those tiny small moments of being there for someone or just seeing someone and actually seeing them as a person, that is the most significant thing. And I think it's beautiful that when you think about it, all of the sweets challenge him in different ways. And some of them are bigger than others. Like he gets beat up at some point and stuff like that. But some of them are so small, so quiet, you know, but they are magnificent to the human experience, you know, like, and I, that's like big lofty words, human experience, but that like the day-to-day connection or seeing someone or being people together is more beautiful almost than him stopping the bank robbery. And like, that's the big heroic thing that sets it off. And yet the person who sends him on this journey with all of the sweets is actually just giving him many chances of connecting with people in so many small ways, really.
It's, I was kind of shooketh over and over again through this book because of how simple and how beautiful these little vignettes are. So I mentioned the 15-year-old runner girl, he sees her running every day at 5:30 in the morning barefoot. And then she goes to her track meets and she loses to the same rival girl a couple of times. And then he finally realizes it's because she's trying to run in shoes. And so he delivers a message, right? I am the messenger. So he delivers the message, which is basically take your shoes off. I see you in the morning. You're so joyous running without your shoes. You know, when you go to your track meets, have some joy in that. Take off your shoes. And so she did. And whether she wins or loses, it's the joy that she gets to experience that, you know, that's the message, right, is helping her find her joy. Or the old lady who just, she's kind of got dementia and she calls him by her long dead husband's name, and he reads Wuthering Heights to her and goes over there, you know, once a week or something. And it's just
like one of my favorites.
Oh, it's just delightful. And then there's darker ones. You mentioned getting beat up, or
the brothers.
Yeah, getting beat up by the brothers, or being asked to shoot a rapist. You know, like there's some dark stuff, but, and I'm trying to not give away what he does with all of these situations, because people really should read it.
Yes.
But in each of them, he finds something beautiful about it, whether it's light or heavy, there's something beautiful there. So,
And I love it culminates. Oh, sorry.
No, please. Culminates.
I was going to say, I love how it all culminates because it's all these strangers, right? And I thought this was brilliant. He has to help these strangers and they get difficult or at least more
mysterious.
Complicated. Yeah. As it goes, you know, like dig deep with the clubs and, you know, stuff like that as he goes. But I love that Hearts comes last and the Hearts is all his people. Like the people that he should have been closest to and is closest to, sure. But that it's like he had to practice on strangers before he was ready to help the people in his own circle, because the intimacy level is so much more significant that it's even harder. And I loved that. It was beautiful. Like watching him, he and his friends actually reached a different level of friendship where it's like, no, we're not just the people who we call to be like, hey, bucko, you know, get me to the store. I need to go shopping or whatever, you know?
Right.
But that he had to actually connect with them almost on a familial level. That was really, really beautiful. And that was also the most challenging one in so many ways.
I hadn't thought of it in that way. But I like that I like how you're saying that he had to learn how to connect with strangers before the ones closest to him. It reminds me of one of my big pet peeves just in life is that we, we're getting lofty. Okay. Let's go for it. One of my big life pet peeves is when people treat their family and their close friends with less respect than they do strangers, right? Mm. Politeness or diplomacy or whatever word you want to put on it. We go to the grocery store or we're talking to a waiter or something and we're unfailingly polite to these people. Mm. And then you go home and you yell at your sister or you get angry at your kids or, you know, you lash out at your mom, what have you. Yeah. So I've always had this pet peeve, like, shouldn't the ones closest to us be the ones most deserving of our respect and love? And this kind of feeds into that. Like, so in your daily life, nobody's going to give you magic playing cards with addresses on them to do this sort of thing. That's not going to happen. But pay attention to whether you treat those closest to you better or worse than strangers. And make sure you're not treating the strangers better, basically. Treat them well too. Don't get me wrong.
don't choose which, like, this is not a which one thing. This is both, please. But I think that's so true. I think that's, I've seen that a lot in my life, even experienced it. It is really sad when the people who are closest to you, you're like, listen, I know you're tired at the end of the day, but also, like, you don't have to treat me like crap at the end of the day either. You know, like we're close because we've picked to be close. So, like, try. And that's part of that love, of course, is the whole weathering each other's more difficult moments. But that shouldn't be the, like, take advantage of them kind of style. Mm. But the, like, because I am practicing being good to people generally, I want to make sure you take it home in the day-to-day, you know?
Yeah.
And in those small day-to-day ways, like Marcus Zusak showcases in all the vignettes where you're like, sometimes it's as simple as reading a book to somebody for like half an hour in your day. Or, you know, sometimes that's the big thing.
It doesn't sometimes have to be grand or...
Doesn't have to be, you know, turning the gun on the guy who was robbing the store at the beginning of the bank at the beginning, and was doing a poor job.
I wanted to make a comparison, but before I do that, I wanted to ask you: are there any other, like, aspects of the book or the character, anything that you want to make sure that we talk about in this conversation?
Ooh, I mean, you already said we're going to talk about the ending, so that's the big one. There's a line in his thing that I love. I think that kind of culminates what we've been talking about, so I'll just bring it up now, which is, like, near the end when he's dancing with Audrey, and he's doing his card, you know, his heart's card, and he says, sometimes people are beautiful, not in what they do, not in what they say, just in what they are. Love that. And I think that feeds into what we've been talking about, you know, the vignettes of, like, look at all of the small ways we could be there for each other. Isn't it beautiful? Just those tiny, tiny connective ways that we forget to appreciate. And yet how powerful.
Amen. the comparison I want to make is to my favorite film of all time, and I would put it in the running for the best film ever made. And a lot of people are going to raise their eyebrows at this, and I don't care because it's that good. And the movie is Groundhog Day.
Oh, yeah.
This felt very Groundhog Day to me. And so if you've seen that movie, then you're kind of familiar with what this book is doing. It's taking this aimless kid. And so he's not the same character as Bill Murray's character in the movie. Right. He's not the same kind of person. But you take this aimless person and give him connection with all these people in his small little town. And suddenly, by the end of the book, he's not making a bunch more money. He doesn't move out of his small town and like go to the big city to, you know, whatever.
Still in it's his just shack.
Right. Just by making those connections, he now has a fuller life, a richer life. So it's a kind of a similar message to Groundhog Day. And the other comparison there, in Groundhog Day, the question over everything that's going on, the question in the background is, who did this to him and why? And how did he break out of it, right? And we have that same mystery here. Who's sending him the cards and why? What is going on? And this is where we get to the ending, where for me, I'll be honest, it fell really flat. So we are going to talk about the ending. If you haven't read the book and you care, then spoiler alert.
Spoilers
right?
ahead is totally cool. Go read the book. It's amazing.
So remind everybody who has read the book, what happens in the end? Who is it that does all this?
Okay. Sorry, I just get so excited about it. So he comes in and like he's finished his hearts card. Everything's kind of pulled together. His life is rich. He's a different person without being a different person. And he comes into his room and it's the author. The author has sent him on this journey, has sent him the cards and was like, I've done all of this because I basically wanted you to have a better life, Ed. And you're sitting there like, whoa. And he never says it's Marcus Zusank. You know, like he doesn't name the author, but it's the author of the story who's like, yeah, I planned all of this because I wanted better things for you. And then he leaves and Ed and Audrey are like, ooh, okay. And they kind of just keep going about their lives, which just seems very them, honestly. You know, if they find out that they're a story, they're like, okay, well, need more milk for my coffee. So, you know, that's the kind of people they are. But I see what you're saying. Like that was when I first read it, I was like, what? Because it was so interesting going through the book, all of this, and you want to know who's sending him these cards, right? How does he know? How does he know about the address? How does he know the teenage girl is running every morning? You know, how can anybody know all of these things and want to send him on this journey specifically? And you think, okay, it must be somebody in the town because they saw the paper. That's why they picked him, because of the heroic moment when he, you know, took the gun away from the gunman, except the gunman had dropped it, you know. And all of this. So you think that there's got to be somebody in the book who's doing it, but you'd have no idea how. How could they know all of this? And how would they know also his friends? That becomes like the spooky moment, because it's all his friends. And you're like, whoa, how did he do this? And then it's the person writing the book, and you're like, whoa. And it feels so trippy, because you're like, you've been really ensconced in this vignette of this person's life, you know, and their experiences connecting with all these different people. And some part of you, you want to know who did it, but this other part of you is like, I'm totally okay with not knowing. Because like in Groundhog Day, you don't find out really why or how the universe suddenly was like, you're going to redo this until you figure things out, you know? And like a lot of contemporary, I guess you'd say somewhere between contemporary fantasy and magical realism. I don't know if I count it as magical realism, but it is that same space of like, how though?
What was that? Stranger Than Fiction, that Will Ferrell movie where the author is like messing with the character's life. It's similar to that. That actually isn't the aspect of it when I say it didn't work for me. I kind of like meta nature of that.
That's really
and, but I'll tell you, why the ending didn't quite work is that as I'm going through this, like you said, there's a part of me that's like, don't tell me who it is. Don't do it. Because again, we'll go back to the Groundhog Day comparison. At the end of Groundhog Day, you've watched all of this happen. And then they walk off into the, well, not sunset, into the sunrise, really.
That's true.
he's finally like lived, he's learned how to live a good life and gets the girl, and they walk off into the sunrise. And you are invited as the viewer to wonder why this all happened. And you're not given the answer. And it lends, this is why, one of the reasons why I love Groundhog Day so much is because the interpretations are infinite. And they say so much about the interpreter write more than it does about the story itself, the interpretations of the story. So I didn't want to know who it was. Yeah. And then he kind of reveals over like two or three layers. There's this person who reveals themselves, and then that person, and then ultimately it's the author of the book. So I didn't want to know in the first place. But in the over the course of those reveals, I was like stricken, because the last the last chapter or so of the book is essentially an extended. And the moral of the story is, and you're given as the reader, he just kind of says, here's what I'm trying to tell you. And that's where for all of the nuance that he's shown, his restraint, he then just beats you over the head with the moral of the story. And I kept wanting him to stop. You know, I'm yelling at my, well, you know, I've got to
worming
iPod,
into the book,
my
covering
phone.
His mouth.
Yeah, as long as we're getting meta, I'm yelling at Marcus Zusak, going, don't do it, don't do it.
No.
So that's why the ending didn't quite work for me. However, I do like that it was the author, because in a way it's this meta commentary about like faith and God and reality, and so it's got some interesting things that you can do with that.
I totally see what you mean, because like, you know, like I was saying, is some part of you doesn't want to know also, because it's so satisfying as it is. So I can totally understand that. On the other hand, like, and it's also kind of a strong tonal shift. Like, it's not, yeah, it's kind of a strong tonal shift from the rest of the book. Suddenly you're like, whoa, like it feels different, which is kind of meant to, I suppose, if you've met the author of your story. But I think that the reason why I love it, at least, is it's the full cycle of what he's saying. And yeah, I think that you're probably right. And that is a little bit like, do you get it? But I love the idea that like he's showing all of these connections in Ed's life and how Ed's life gets richer. And then you see that Ed was always loved by his author, and that his author also loves him, you know, and how that creates that full circle of like something as small as writing a book has been a way of seeing people and then connecting people, you know? So I really like that.
You know, there's a term that's come up in the last few years since TikTok got really big, and the term is main character syndrome.
Oh, yeah.
And right, you know what I'm talking about?
Yeah.
Everybody thinks everybody is the main character in their own story, but you can take that too far and think, no, I'm supposed to be the main character in everybody's story.
Everyone's right? story. Yeah.
And I feel like there's some commentary there as well, where, like I say, it gets taken too far, maybe in the TikTok generation, but there's a kernel of truth there where if you can step back and look at your life like a story, what are you doing with it? Is it an interesting or exciting story? Then we stray into fake ancient Chinese proverbs, right? I don't know if it's fake, but you know, what is it? May you lead an interesting life, or something along those lines, or live in interesting times. But yeah, there's something there where that meta thing invites you to analyze your own life as a main character. I don't know. What do you think?
Kind of the way that Ed sort of was, and how I also got to say, like, the fact that this is also Australian and set in Australia means a lot to me. I'm not Australian.
Really?
My family is not Australian. I actually have quite a bit of family in Australia, but I don't know them. But so much of Australian culture, you know, and I'm sure there's going to be lots of Australians who get mad about this. Sorry, guys. You know, but a lot of Australian culture has a lot of overlap with English culture. And that's where half of my family lives. And that's what my mom is. You know, she's still a British citizen, you know. And so getting that, like, I don't know if, like, I just love how it feels so different from how, like, an American would write this story, for example. You know, where, like, the story would be about Ed, like, becoming more successful, maybe, you know, if we're playing in hard into American, you know, stereotypes like that. Yeah, stereotypes. But that what I love is that it's that take, you know, and how his family, like, they give him, like, they take the Mickey out of him, and they and they, like, make sure they've got that very strong attitude, which is also very present in England, of like, hey, don't try to be too much, okay? You know, don't think you're too much better than everybody, you know. And Ed, which is why they, like, at the very beginning, they tell Ed, you know, when he's like, but does my life matter? Am I doing anything with it? And they're like, who do you think you are? He's like, never mind.
Yeah.
But that the whole journey is him figuring out, like, does life matter, and finding out that yes, and it didn't have to be the big things that, like, he was measuring other people in his life by, like, maybe his successful younger brother Tommy, and stuff like that. But it was in the quality of your life generally, which I think wraps back into that, yeah, with the author, you know, it does invite you, because that was Ed's journey, is realizing, like, maybe the answer is different than I suspected, but that there is more, you know, in the ability to have a richer life. And it doesn't often look the way you were imagining it, because I think oftentimes we imagine first in stereotypes, and then we experience, and then we enlarge upon, you know, we enlarge upon our experience and our imagination together into something that's a little bit more true.
Yeah.
But I love that quality of it. It's such a good book.
I think that's a pretty good place to start wrapping up, because ultimately what it comes down to is, yeah, I freaking loved this book. You know, I obviously have my issues with the ending, but anybody who's listened to an episode with Todd on it knows that, you know, Todd's cliche is he's driving down the road and he has to pull over and cry. You know, in the middle of, like, book four of The Wheel of Time or something like that. It's just everything makes Todd cry. And I don't share that with Todd. This book had me, like, stopping. I would go on walks, you know, so I do a lot of walking. And so I'd put in my headphones and listen to the book and go on long walks. And I would just stop and just kind of cry for a little while. Like, this is one of the most beautiful things I've ever seen.
Yes, I
absolutely adored it. It is outside of our normal milieu as far as sci-fi fantasy. But yeah, we'll call it magical realism, and we'll slot it in there somewhere. We'll call it a subgenre of fantasy.
And, you know, bringing it into this reminded me again of, like, how it can be really, really valuable to read outside your normal genre, particularly if you're, like, a creative and you're producing and stuff like that. How occasionally reading something that seems outside of what you'd usually read can bring new life to what you do read or write or create.
Yes. So. Yeah, this is not going to stop being a sci-fi fantasy podcast. No. Don't worry, everybody. But exactly, it's so important to keep your horizons reasonably broad. You don't have to read everything. You don't have to try to consume every piece of media. But this would be a book
for little gold nuggets here and there.
Yes, yes. This is a book I would hand to basically anybody. I mean, there are a few difficult pieces of subject matter, so you know, maybe there's an age floor somewhere and you can decide where that is, but yeah, I'd recommend this to anybody. So Kayla, thank you for choosing this book.
Thanks for letting me gush about it. I do not have many opportunities to be like, guys, I am the messenger. Let me tell you how cool it is.
it's fabulous. It's really, really good. Okay, but from one fabulous book to another we go. Well, I three of them. So Kayla, you've got a new book coming out, and it'll be out March 12th, which I think will be before this episode airs, or maybe it'll be around that time.
Ooh.
So by the time people listen to this, they can go order it or pre-order it. That's awesome if you do that.
Pre-order.
And the new book is called CC Rios and the Queen of Brujas. And this is the third book in your trilogy. I've read the first book, which is CC Rios and the Desert of Souls. And then there's the King of Fears.
And the King of Fears.
That's
everybody
two.
Loves that cover. I love that.
It's really good. Yeah. So you write books for aimed at younger audiences. Why don't you tell us a little bit about this trilogy and then we'll get everybody to go out and buy it.
Lovely. Yeah, so Sicirios in the Desert of Souls is about a 12-year-old girl who has to become a bruja, or a witch, who is a, like, dark person who controls, like, criaturas, shapeshifter souls, in order to rescue her older sister who gets kidnapped by the dark criatura, El Sombrerón. And El Sombrerón, like, it's filled with all kinds of folklore, like, folklore, myth, and particularly some old Aztec and Nahuatl, Aztec legend and Nahuatl language as well. And there's a glossary in the back if you're, like, intimidated by that. Don't worry, I'll give you some background. I even give a little bit of background in the glossary of, like, where the original sort of generally is and how I've altered interpretation a little bit. Because I do love doing that, you know. For example, El Sombrerón, like, he's terrifying, like, 8-foot-tall siren who steals women, right? In actuality, he's, like, 3 feet tall, you know, in legend. But he's terrifying. Like, he does still steals ladies in legend, and that's terrifying. And they're like, ah, little El Sombrerón who braids horse's hair. And I'm like, he steals people. That's scary. So I made it scarier.
Nice.
And the second.
Yeah, I really enjoyed the first book because it weaves in those things that I am not familiar with. Like, I didn't grow up learning Mexican folklore and right. et cetera. But it weaves all that stuff in a way that's fun and makes you want to learn more about, oh, where did this come from? Yeah. And the glossary in the back is great as well for that.
Appreciate that.
So that's book one.
Yes. And,
well, you don't have to tell us. You don't have to tell us the plot of book two. People should get there, right?
Yeah. I was going to say it kind of spoils some of book one, right?
Yeah, exactly.
But in, I'll just say that in book two, they go down into Devil's Alley, which is where the shape-shifting criaturas are from. And they have to face El Cucoy, who is like, El Cucoy is like the boogeyman. Mm. But he is the king of all criaturas in this world. So he's terrifying, but kind of like trapped in Devil's Alley.
Yeah.
So they have to face him. And I'm so excited that the third book is coming out March 12th. It was supposed to come out like September of last year. But there was a strike and a whole bunch of things happened and it got pushed anyway. You know, I wrote this book when I had mono. So I was trying so hard to keep it on time and then it got pushed out anyway. And I was like, oh, but now it's finally here. And I actually got like my author copies just earlier this week.
Oh, nice.
And they're so beautiful. I really want to eat them. There's like something about the cover that looks so delicious. I'm like, that's not food, and I have to keep reminding myself.
Let's say I think all three covers are very attractive, and because they're aimed at younger readers, they use those kind of here's an oxymoron for you. They use some very bold pastels, and it does kind of look like candy, right? So they're very inviting looking.
That was like a conversation I had with the publisher. I was like, it needs to have high saturation. This is non-negotiable, you know, like I know in America particularly we associate bright colors with like childhood, so it's still appropriate, you know. But like in Mexico everything is bright colors because bright colors, you know. And when you have access to lots of dyes historically, why not use them, you know?
Yeah.
So well, I was like so happy about that.
So it's Sicirios and the Desert of Souls is book one. And then you can look up the others from there. I'll link to all of this in the description below. But I'll just remind everybody of one of my theories of literature or art, really. It's art generally, which is that a piece of art, a great piece of art may have an age floor, but it has no age ceiling. And I don't care how old you are. The first book, which is the one that I've read so far, is super fun and you would enjoy it. Go out and grab a copy for yourself, your kids, whatever.
Thank you.
And I say that I come by my opinion honestly here. So Kayla, thank you.
I agree about the floor and ceiling. That's good. So true.
I'm pretty confident in that one. Kayla, thank you so much for coming back, I should say, and for picking this book and for talking with me for a little while. It's been absolutely lovely. And what are you going to be celebrating on March 12th? Are you going to?
Yes. Yes. Well, on March 15th, actually, I'm running a big literacy event for the Alpine School District, where we're going to invite all of the Title I schools. They're going to go into this big interactive play where they're going to help me release my book because it gets captured. Nice. And then secretly, we're just going to give them a bunch of books. Very excited about it.
Oh, that's really nice. Oh, that's great.
Lightweaver was like a really big, important donator. We've been really, really grateful that all of like the local libraries have participated and that the Alpine School District has been helping support. So literacy is important. Woo.
She says to the listeners of the book club podcast.
Yeah.
I think you're preaching to the choir here, Kayla. All right, everybody. Like I said, go to the show notes and I'll have a link to Kayla's website. You can check out the books there. If you're an elementary school principal, you know, well, I was going to say in Utah, but hey, it could be anywhere. You could probably fly Kayla out somewhere, but you do, school, what's the word I'm looking for? Assemblies.
And,
yeah. School visits. So you can do that.
They're so fun.
So that'll be in the description. Also, make sure you check out thelegendarium.com for all the regular stuff, the link to Discord where you can join the conversation, the link to Patreon where you can donate. And we do actually have extras now. So you do get a few goodies, like Todd reading The Wheel of Time is Patreon exclusive. So thelegendarium.com is where you can check all of that out. Thank you so much for listening, everybody. And I will see you next time.